Zimbabwe suspension, the Euro T20 Slam draft analysis, Canadian Global T20 preview, and the end of the Hong Kong Blitz, as well as a whole lot more around the world. And now on 91.3 Sport FM, welcome to the Emerging Cricket Podcast. Hello and welcome to the Emerging Cricket Podcast, where we dissect the news and events from cricket's new world. Just loving that Red Gazelle there in the intro and the outro for the show. Great to be back with you wherever you do listen to your podcasts, as well as the home of sport in Perth, 91.3 FM. I'm Daniel Beswick, and I'm joined by the usual suspects once more, Tim Cutler in Brisbane. Tim, how are you?
Oh, keep on keeping on, Bez, trying to fit three lives into one. How are you?
Oh, look, yeah, almost the same. Throwing a little bit more responsibility in my day job, which has made EC work a little bit more difficult, but trying to juggle everything at once and keeping my head above water. How many cliches can I fit in a sentence? Go. As well, today or tonight on the show, our man known by many on Twitter as Copernicus Cricket, Nick Skinner. Nick, how's things?
Yeah, not too bad. Similar sort of situation with a bunch of life chores piling up, but got to keep going with the emerging cricket content, don't we?
Yeah, especially after the week we've just had, boys. Plenty of stuff off the field, actually, which will probably dominate proceedings tonight as we do head straight into our first topic. Also, let us know where you are enjoying the podcast with the hashtag ECPod. I think we have listeners from around about 80 countries now, which is fantastic. But do let us know where you are listening to us. Let's jump straight into our first topic of the week, and it is a sour one with the ICC suspending Zimbabwe or the Zimbabwean board for a multitude of reasons. The official reasoning given at least was failing to provide a process for free and democratic elections and failing to ensure that there's no government interference in its governance. This is, of course, after the Zimbabwean Sports and Recreation Committee last month suspended the cricket board over allegations of corruption and financial irregularities. It's the first time that this has happened to a full member. They're out of tournaments, their funding has been frozen, domestic competitions and player salaries have been cancelled. It raises the question, I guess, of how Kenya got away with it, as well as several other full members, such as India, South Africa, Sri Lanka and Pakistan have all had situations similar to this. Huge implications for the players who I think are the biggest victims in all this. Solomon Mire is retired already. Sikander Raz is retired, of course, although he has been picked up by the Amsterdam Knights in the Euro T20 Slam, which we will discuss a little bit later. And the Zimbabwe women have been banned from the ICC Global Development Squad as well.
Yeah, they were going to play in the Kia Super League in the UK, and I think their visas had been approved, and that was a really exciting development. You know, the women's team had got through the global qualifiers, but that was great for their development. You know, thinking of tournaments, you know, we've got the ODI Super League that starts early next year with Zimbabwe being one of the 13 teams. You know, what happens there? And then if teams are coming up into that, if, let's say, Scotland move up into that, what happens in Cricket World Cup League 2 and the ODI League there? Does that mean Canada come up from the Challenge Leagues, and then does Germany come up into the Challenge League? Who knows? Well, that's sort of a more long-term question around these longer leagues, and the ICC did say they're going to review at their October meeting. So for the sakes of Zimbabwe, you hope that that's rectified and they're allowed to play again. But in the meantime, we've got the women's T20 World Cup qualifier coming up in a couple of weeks that they won't be in. The men's T20 qualifier will be in the UAE around the same time as that review meeting in October. And then we've also got an under 19 World Cup coming up. And we've heard whispers about various teams being approached across Germany, Namibia, Nepal, and others. You know, it's almost unprecedented. You know, it got close in 2015. If you remember, the West Indies had a player dispute between the World Cup qualifier in 2014 and the World Cup across Australia and New Zealand in early 2015. And there was talk of them having to pull out of the tournament, and Hong Kong were actually contacted and put on standby. And it never got, this is before I started at Cricket Hong Kong, but it was definitely, there was contact made of saying, well, if this happens, are you ready to go? So I dare say that there's quite a few people sort of rushing around offices and whatnot in in ICC land in Dubai trying to get this sorted, because you know it's one thing not having a team in the tournament, but then how you're trying to make an event around it. You know, we saw the Asia, the Eastern region qualifiers for the ACC under 19s, and I know it's at a different level, but with Myanmar pull out and having two pools of three, you know, it really does muck around with tournament structures, especially when you've got different pools as the T20 World Cup qualifier for men is. So, yeah, lots of questions still going unanswered about this.
Yeah, this is really bad. And I mean, first off, like I remember when I was a kid, little wicketkeeper playing junior cricket, you know, Tatenda Taibu and Andy Flower were massive inspirations for me. So it's sad on a personal level seeing a team that I really like watching in this situation. But it's massively unfair on the players, as you've alluded to, Bez, to suffer the consequences for the administrative politics going on in the boardroom. And it's shameful that this situation is being decided by boardroom politics in the first place. Let's not forget, why the SRC stepped in the first place. Zimbabwe cricket's been run into the ground by a series of grifters and Mugabe cronies with millions of dollars in ICC disbursements going missing and facilities in disrepair and a steady stream of talent draining away from the country. You know, guys like Blessing Mirzazurabani most recently, or, Gary Balance going back a few years, or, even Brendan Taylor spent a few years in international timeout securing his future, I guess, with a Colpack deal. And you could make probably a list of over 20 players who've just left the country for better opportunities. And it's all to do with the chaotic administration that's been going on for nearly two decades now. So, I mean, yeah, to be fair to the ICC, government intervention is understandably something they want to discourage, and I get that. And, the fact is the head of the SRC, Gerald Mlotshwa, is the Zimbabwean president's son-in-law. So that indicates that, the ICC probably has a pretty good case that government interference is happening. But government interference is one of those things that it cuts both ways, in the sense that if a government is stepping in to combat corruption in its jurisdiction, who's the ICC to tell them no? Is the government supposed to just let people be corrupt, because they're connected to cricket? That doesn't make sense. So, and, it's not like this is the first time the government has meddled in Zimbabwean cricket, or indeed in various other full members. As, just recently, Afghanistan's Twitter account was announcing that the president has appointed their chairman, like it's no big deal. And Imran Khan's just been making a speech about how he's going to go and clean up Pakistani cricket. So there's some government interference, but I doubt the ICC is going to suspend Afghanistan or Pakistan in this case. And you see some of the stories from, back towards the start of this crisis, back in the mid-2000s, it's genuinely scary stuff. Like, Tatenda Taibu's family was chased through the streets by Mugabe government operatives, and Heath Streak's family farm was on a list of properties set for government confiscation until it came back from the player strike. So, there's some government interference. And even Malcolm Speed, who was the ICC CEO, they threatened to deport him when he flew into Harare to try and make sense of the mess. So, no action there. But dissolving in a corrupt board, well, that's going too far, apparently. So, I think the fact that they've suspended Zimbabwe now, rather than at any point in the last 15 to 20 years, shows that this is really not about good governance. It's about the old guard, led by Tevengwa Mukulani, fighting back against their ousting and using the players as pawns, really, as pawns to try and leverage their way back into power. Because let's not forget, when the USA and Nepal, a couple of pet projects, let's say, for the ICC, when they were suspended, and Nepal still are suspended, they were allowed to continue playing on the field. And in fact, the ICC stepped in to run the cricket administration. So the fact they're not letting Zimbabwe do the same is it's a heavy-handed play against the SRC. And again, it highlights the self-serving nature of it all. Mukulani wants his job back, and cricket in Zimbabwe is just collateral damage. And the ICC board, they can see the dollar signs in the US and Nepal, so they take the softly approach and let them keep going. But they're happy to trample over the green shoots in the Zimbabwean games. So basically, the fact that the ICC is stepping in to defend the previous status quo, which is the cause of all the problems in the first place, it's disgraceful.
Oh, fantastic. We were here for Nick Skinner's first emerging cricket rant on the podcast. I'm honoured to be here, Nick. That was outstanding. You are quite right, though. The ICC are involved in Nepal cricket as we speak, and the ICC came out and basically earmarked the USA, Germany, and Nepal as three booming economies or cricket economies for the good of the game. And you look to Zimbabwe now, and yeah, I think the ICC are asking themselves where, well, we don't see any dollar signs here anymore. Zimbabwe's financial situation has been poor for so long. There's only so long we can keep these guys and drag them along with us. And I think they've just said enough's enough. But you are quite right. Making the players the victims in all this is really sad, because there's plenty of talent in Zimbabwean cricket, as we know. And yeah, I feel a little bit heartbroken, actually, to be honest, thinking of the Sikander Razas and the other players. Solomon Mure basically hanging up the boots, actually had a picture of him with his spikes up on some sort of frame that he timed up, which was fantastic.
Yes, literally hanging up the boots there. You mentioned the financial situation. Well, there's another story. I would recommend our listeners Google the Metbank scandal, which is where the previous board, the one that was suspended, allegedly used ICC money to enrich a bank that they were sitting on the board of. So that sort of gives you an indication of the level of governance we've come to expect from Zimbabwean cricket over the years.
And just to wrap up some of the ICC meeting findings, a couple of other suspensions and expulsions that we should talk about before we do move on. Croatia and Zambia have also been suspended by the ICC. Croatia essentially down to fudging their participation numbers. Zambia had failed to attend ICC meetings in recent months. And the expulsion for Morocco is essentially down to not responding to ICC contact over several months, which is hugely disappointing. Let's move on to the Euro T20 Slam draft, which was last Friday in London.
Biz, just as you're talking about Morocco, and before we move on to the Slam, let's not forget that Morocco has actually hosted full member international cricket, because the the Morocco Cup was held in 2002 at the Tangier Cricket Ground or Cricket Stadium.
South Africa, was it?
Yeah, so we should probably know this as being his niche. South Africa. Either way, it was $25 million spent on the stadium to build. We've got a great long piece from Steve Maneri, who's visited Morocco a number of times, both playing and as a journalist as well, coming up on emergingcricket.com shortly. But it's a really sad story that the game had been growing nicely, and it started growing amongst the local population. That ground itself is in disrepair. A second ground they had access to is also a bit of a shambles. And now this. So, yeah, I think it sounds like there's a few passionate people down there that have been working really hard, but not necessarily the ones that have been holding the purse strings.
Yeah, 7 matches were held there in Tangiers in the early 2000s.
Yeah, Sri Lanka beat South Africa in the final of that series. Jayasuriya special in the end there.
Yeah, I do seem to remember Jayasuriya going ballistic there. It does ring a bell. It's a great trivia question, that one, as well as which South American country has hosted Test cricket, which is a little bit of a trick question.
Guyana.
That question wasn't for you, Nick. We know you know.
Which is part of the West Indies.
The other question I love is, where did Bradman debut in Test cricket?
Oh, that is a good one.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. It's a Brisbane exhibition ground.
Yes. That was a pointless answer at one point too, as Australian Test venues, because no one remembers the Brisbane exhibition ground.
Now, Bez, is there something you want to tell us about pointless?
Nah.
Did you go on that once?
Look, I think that ship has sailed, but...
You updated your Twitter bio, didn't you? You had on it, one-time pointless champion. Is that still on there?
I think it is. If anyone has episode 13 of season 1 of the Australian Pointless, feel free to send it over to me, because I've lost my copy of it. I need to get in contact with Channel 10 to get it back.
When you say season 1, hasn't that show been cancelled now?
There was 2 seasons though, so... Yes, you're correct, but there was multiple seasons. And yeah, so the 13th ever episode of the show. The third jackpot winner, I think. And we were at one point the highest earners on the show. That was a record that didn't stand very long, though.
So what did you do with your money in the end? Were you at a holiday to Sri Lanka that turned into a holiday to India?
Yeah, that and I suppose our World Cricket League 2 expedition was... I think my alcoholic beverage consumption was amplified by some of the prize money there as well, to be perfectly honest with you. Let's move on to the Euro T20 Slam Draft that was last Friday in London. A reminder that the Slam does start on the 30th of August. It's a three-week tournament with a week in the Netherlands, a week in Scotland, and then a week in Ireland. The draft was run with Darren Goff as the compere for the draft, which did raise a few eyebrows and a little bit of criticism by several people. And I'm sure that both of you will get into that in a minute. I want to ask a couple of things. Guys, if we have looked at the teams on paper, where do we kind of see these teams? And how do we think it was all kind of run and organized last Friday? Because there was quite a few people that came out and said that Darren Goff might have not perhaps been the best person to have, but it does seem like it could have been an 11th hour appointment, Nick.
Yeah, I think it's pretty clear he didn't really know what was going on. He just didn't have much knowledge of the players or the teams, basically, was the issue, which, you know, when you're looking for a host for this sort of thing, knowing who the players are is a big plus.
Yeah, and even if they'd potentially brought someone up on stage for the second half with the, let's call it the local player draft, but as far as we understand it, those decisions have been made before time anyway. If you look at the Ireland teams, it was very clearly along north and south lines about who went where, and what we've heard elsewhere that everything had basically been arranged beforehand. Likewise with a lot of the picks earlier on, which, look, it's great to have a draft and a bit of extra exposure, but, you know, you want there to be sort of a bit of a level playing field, and thinking that people are making these decisions under the spotlights. You know, it's interesting seeing some familiar faces in the crowd. Jared Kimber there working with the Edinburgh Rocks. I see he had the table with the castle as opposed to the bagpipe playing a moustached man.
dear.
Oh, yes.
So it's good to see Jared get around, friend of the podcast. But, yeah, look, these things are never easy, and you're being broadcast live. And to have a name like Darren Goff there is great. I know from we heard that Alan Wilkins was supposed to be there but couldn't make it. But, you know, geez, it's run by Cricket Ireland. Andrew Leonard has been commentating the last few Ireland internationals. Get him involved. He would know every player on there and would be able to share an anecdote about each player as they're selected or assigned teams, rather than just saying, well done, son, you got a game of cricket after everyone. There seemed to be a lot of moments of inertia between picks and whatnot with the system, which seemed to run a bit quicker than it did for the global T20, which is good. But, yeah, look, ultimately it fell a bit flat, and I think a bit of criticism on Twitter with people having a go at him and coming back and saying, well, I only had the job for 24 hours. I don't think that's the right answer to that, really. It's, well, that should have been prepared, or at least been given some speed notes on a lot of the players. You know, you had players with scores of international games for their country being spoken about like a stranger. I don't think it's great when if this is effectively a home tournament for these three nations.
Yeah, on Goff, I thought he brought a lot of energy to start with and was good. And then gradually, of course, when the local players came out, it was gradually worse and the knowledge was scarce. So, yeah, when you have 24 hours, you'd like to think that he would have done a little bit of research, but you never really know how busy he was. Speaking of Jared Kimber, actually, I did rewatch Death of a Gentleman yesterday in my free time, which was thoroughly enjoyable once again.
Shouldn't you have been writing something for EC then? What's this free time you speak of?
Geez, a slave driver, isn't he?
I was multitasking, Tim. That's why I've got two monitors here in my little office. And, you know, I can walk and chew, as Peter Delapena likes to say. It is possible. I want to talk about the draft itself and the players that were picked. My thoughts, I guess, on which teams I think are put together well, a couple that I'm not too sure about. I wanted to talk about one sort of curious moment was from the Dublin Chiefs during their draft process. Now, you had 3 minutes to deliver a pick, and under some sort of pressure or duress, I'm not really sure, the Dublin Chiefs actually passed for one of their picks, and that meant that their pick went to the end of the round. And then once they were given another opportunity at the end of the round to make a pick, they were shuffling bits of paper all over the place and ended up selecting a gentleman by the name of Corbin Bosch, who plays domestic T20 cricket in South Africa. Did have to do a little bit of research on him when they picked him, because it was such a strange one to think that, you know, given that other teams were picking high-end international players, for the Dublin Chiefs to come out and make that pick, it was, yeah, very curious. Nick, I know you have plenty of thoughts about some of the teams. Teams that I think I like Amsterdam, the Amsterdam side, and the Dublin Chiefs, actually, the Bosch picker side. You never know. He might turn out to be an excellent player.
Yeah, maybe they know something we don't.
I'm not too sure on the Rotterdam side. And then, yeah, I'm not too sure how I feel about the Scottish sides, just because I just think there's plenty of variables there. Nick, what do you sort of think of the teams?
Yeah, more or less agree with you. I think the probably Dublin's just about the strongest looking team. Again, aside from the interesting choice of Corbin Bosch there. But I think the Amsterdam, well, I like to call them the Night Watch, but they're just the Knights officially. They do look a bit light on batting if Watson and Vassay don't get going early, but I think they've definitely got the strongest bowling lineup, so they could potentially not need so much batting if, you know, they've got guys like, you know, Zafar and Sikandar Razor with the spin, and Rola Fandemuva as well, and Paul van Meekeren and Imran Tahir. Yeah, so they've got a lot of bowling options, and Alzari Joseph as well. So they should be able to restrict teams to very gettable targets, I would say.
So you just talked about Saad Bin Safar, who I'm pretty sure that he's the only associate player picked outside the Dutch and Scottish players. Would I be correct in saying that?
You are. And great for him. Enjoyed watching him live for the first time in Namibia, but yeah, it's just really disappointing when we've got the likes of Corbin Bosch and Jan Frylik's older brother Robert selected. You know, we've got guys who've played franchise cricket and a bit of stuff for South Africa. You know, these could have been reserved spots for associates, or like we talked about, European associates. And I don't know, my heart really dropped to see some of these names that were called out when this could have really been a hero event. And in the end, here we are, we're trying to work out who Corbin Bosch is.
Yeah, well, when John Smuts was picked up by the Glasgow Giants,
you thought it was JJ Smith, didn't you?
I'm not going to lie. I was hoping it was JJ Smith, because he could be one of my favourite players in associate cricket at the moment, the way he goes about his business. I think it's fantastic. But yeah, looking at the teams, the two Scottish teams for me are actually quite interesting, because I don't know if they're going to top the league, if they're going to win the comp, or they're going to come dead last. I look at some of the international guys that have been picked for both of them. Martin Guptill's has come off an absolute horror of a World Cup. I know that they made the final and he had that excellent run out, but with the bat, he was pretty poor, and he'll be the first person to probably say that. You've got guys like Chris Lynn and Corey Anderson who are essentially flying in and out for a tournament. I'm not too sure how much cricket they've played. Tamal Mills was a bit of a flop, I would say. I don't think that's been too harsh at Hobart. Over 2 years, and he got injured in the second year. I think he's one ball away from another back injury.
It was just too expensive, wasn't he? Like, bowl with good pace, but just when you had, that's when Jofra was there, wasn't he, at the other end? I'm trying to think who was at the Hobart Hurricanes at the same time.
Sean Tate played for them for a little bit, didn't he?
Was Jofra there as well?
Yeah, Jofra came in. I think they've been there at the same time.
Yeah, he just seemed to keep getting pongoed everywhere that year, didn't he?
Yeah, he did. He's very hittable.
And I guess as you're talking about Tamal Mills, why don't you mention about, you know, one-time Blitz sign up, and then
I didn't even realize he played in the Blitz.
No, he was signed for the Blitz, and then he got picked in the IPL, and he suddenly had a hamstring strain, so he couldn't come home from
it. Oh yes, all of a sudden. Well, I think he could be one ball away from another injury in this tournament. I would be very, if I was a person drafting these teams, I'd be very wary of picking him. But Edinburgh have picked him, and hopefully they get as much use out of him as they can. And then looking at Glasgow, just still on these Scottish teams, you know, Brendan McCullum's just come off 8 weeks commentating the World Cup. I don't think he's been in a successful T20 team in quite a while. I only know this because I actually get notifications for all of Brendan McCullum's tweets, and I swear every 10th one is normally an apology to the fans of the T20 team that he's playing for, that they didn't make the finals or they lost a semi-final or whatever. So, and the Brisbane Heat, the Bash Brothers didn't exactly come off last year either. But you never know. Dale Steyn's coming back from injury, and Ravi Bapara, I think he's still winning games for Essex in England. So you never know. They could piece it all together. But Yeah, I'm intrigued to see how this tournament goes. Ideally, in these tournaments, you'd want to see a bit more development in European cricket with regards to players from continental Europe playing as well, outside of the Netherlands in this case, obviously. But yeah, I would have loved to have seen a little bit more of what the ECL is doing and having, you know, guys obviously playing from continental Europe. I thought that would have been a really good opportunity, but unfortunately was missed.
Yeah, and speaking of that, I was surprised at just how few players nominated from continental Europe. Just looking down, the three from Germany, a couple from Italy, and then we saw a single from Czech Republic and also from Russia. I know there's been a bit of a clash with some of the League Two matches, and that hit Namibia and the USA. But I just think, you know, I don't want to do it to death and bore everyone to tears, but just missed a real chance here that, you know, for the amount of money that's gone to full member overseas that may never play, and I'm looking at the absolute worst end of the spectrum, you could have had some local European talent learning from the best, and even if they never got in the park, they'd be in such a better position, and cricket gets more out of it than paying another full member T20 journeyman to come and sit on the bench.
Yeah, here's where I plug Nikolaj Legsgaard Damgaard from Denmark once again. Tall left arm fingerspin bowler, keeps very tight. You're right. But the Scottish teams I just wanted to talk about briefly again. I think those two, the Edinburgh Rocks, oh, gosh, these names are terrible. Edinburgh and Glasgow.
Can we just refer to them by their city and just, like, we've been told that the Amsterdam Knights is called so because the same owner of the Vancouver Knights, who of course won the first year of Global T20 Canada with Bubba Hyatt smashing them down at number six, has also bought their Amsterdam. So he wanted to have the same name across too. So I'm all for the Knight Riders for those guys, or even the, what was it, the Knights Watch of Amsterdam?
Night Watch, like the Rembrandt painting.
Yeah, okay. So I think from now on, we just refer to the city names and never speak of it again.
Yeah, well, I'm just worried that I mix and match the two. So I get the right city, but the wrong nickname because there's such new teams and there hasn't been sort of like any cognition going on.
You mean because there's such new teams and their names of the teams have no reference to those cities that they're from whatsoever.
And they're so generic. Giants, Chiefs, Titans. I mean, it's all the same thing, isn't it?
That doesn't help.
Yeah, just going back to those Scottish teams, Bez, the Edinburgh and Glasgow sort of dished out the Scottish squad very well, I thought. They're both very balanced in terms of the local players, whereas I think the Amsterdam Night Watch got a much better deal in terms of which Dutch players are on their side, and I think the Rotterdam Rhinos are going to be struggling, I think, a little bit.
We should come up with another name. We can either refer to cities only, or we come up with our own names and we refer to it as the Euro Thrash, thanks to Bertus.
Rotterdam has one of the world's biggest ports, so you could go with the Rotterdam Dockers.
But Cambo's for the wrong team then.
Wouldn't know what to do with himself, would he?
Yeah, imagine him coming up against the Dockers. He'd hate that.
Yeah, Amsterdam Eagles, he'd be out of there in a second. But again, you look at this, as we talk, like we joke about the names. Here was another example to get some local engagement and have a naming and logo competition from those cities to have people write in, get the young designers to have a go and then pick something and you give that person a bit of press about congratulations, you know, mini 13 years old from Edinburgh who designed this. It's a free hit to me that could have been done. And I guess, like they said, they pushed the boat out by holding it this year, and some things were going to be perhaps not done as they'd like. I think it's fair to say that the naming of the teams and local engagement is one of those things.
Well, from one Mercury Group owned T20 competition to another. Oh yeah, that was slick. Let's have a look at the Global T20 Canada. When you do listen to this, it will have already begun. There's still six teams in the comp with the addition of one team, the Brampton Wolves, after the New York debacle, the team that didn't exist or did exist very, very briefly. They're in with the West Indies B team no longer in the Global T20. Pretty tough to gauge, I guess, which teams do stand out, but I do see a lot of potential in the Vancouver side. Nick, you discussed, I guess, while we were sort of putting these notes together for the podcast, that the slow wickets in Brampton might actually undo them. But there is certainly a lot of potential in that Vancouver side.
Yeah, they're stacked with big hitters, aren't they? The Vancouver synergies, I think we can call them, because of the connection with the Euro T20 there. So they've got Tobias Fiese and Chris Gayle presumably opening the batting. Rizwan Chima, JJ Smith, Andre Russell. So, you know, they've got a stacked lineup of big hitters there. But as you mentioned, the pitchers... well, according to Peter Della Penna, who was on the scene, they're reusing the pitches that were used in the Shane Warne and Sachin Tendulkar's Cricket All-Stars project in the US several years ago, and apparently they've just been sort of sitting in storage all these years, and they're just being dumped into the Brampton field. So those pitches, you know, 4 years ago were already a bit slow. So yeah, I would suspect they wouldn't have too much life in them now, which, as I was saying, might cause the big hitting teams to struggle a bit, and the teams with maybe more of a spin bowling experience would do a bit better. So I think someone like a Montreal Tigers might do okay, because, you know, they've got Nikhil Dutta and Sunil Narayan spin bowlers, and even Dylan Heiliger, the Canadian fast bowler who can bend his back and get some more life out of the pitch. Whereas, you know, yeah, I think if you're relying on guys who swing big and hit through the line, they're going to struggle on these pitches.
Yeah, I'm just looking at these squads here, and with that in mind, I'm not entirely sure who really sticks out. A team like Edmonton with Shadab Khan might be hugely influential. I'm talking about Shadab, of course. Brampton with Shahid Afridi is predominantly used more as a bowler rather than as a batsman, might be able to find something in it, and he did play in the Global T20 last year. But yeah, I have to say that there's not a whole lot that stands out in all these teams. Again, I do think that Vancouver on a quick deck would probably have the leading team, but if you're talking horses for courses, I think that they probably haven't brought the right horses to the course.
Just on that Brampton side, actually, I mean, they're the only team the only actual local team, but I think they have a pretty good case to probably be favourites ahead of this tournament, maybe. You know, they've got Nitish Kumar, who'll give them some good stability with the bat and local experience, and obviously Shakib Al Hassan's in monstrous form.
He's just, yeah, come off the World Cup of his life, yeah.
And bowl spin, and, you know, obviously Baba Hayat is another good get. As you said, Shahid Afridi bowling his sort of skiddy leg spin. And local boy Faisal Jamkandi, who topped the wicket tally in the 2018 Under-19s World Cup, I think will play a big part as well. So they've got a good local contingent and a good foreign contingent that will probably match the conditions better than some other teams. And that's actually one of the elements that I think will be really interesting, you know, seeing how these teams balance their overseas players with the local Canadian quota.
Yeah, you look at some of the peripheral picks, perhaps it could make a difference. But yeah, I was surprised that you guys took as long as you did to sort of mention Shakib. You know, he's up there with Darren Sammy for the Wolves, and I think he's going to play such a important position for that team, potentially opening the bowling, maybe one or two overs in the middle, or maybe even at the end, and his sort of pace and control. And I saw some pictures of the outfield as well. It's looking quite lush, and I'm not sure quite how flat it is and whether it's going to be up to the standards of the grounds that these guys are used to playing on. So I'm getting the feeling it's going to be quite similar to King City again, which is a little bit worrying, and especially if there's any weather around. I think, was it also PDP saying that they'd built the sight screens too close to the grandstand? The groundsman couldn't get their tractors and stuff into to tend to the new wicket. So, it's these things that are done so quickly, sometimes the basics can be missed. But, yeah, I'm looking forward to it. What time is it going to be on? Are they trying to get it to India time?
Yeah, so looking at the page, there's going to be matches at 4 o'clock local time and 11 a.m. local time. They're going to start with a couple of afternoon fixtures. Just doing some quick maths, Big Shaq style, quick maths.
Showing your age there, or lack thereof.
the morning games will be about 8:30 Mumbai time, I believe, but the afternoon matches will be late into the night. So I'm not really sure what the end game is there for the Canadian T20, especially when it's owned by an Indian company and trying to get that Indian viewership. So it's an interesting move there, but at least half the games will be shown in prime time.
Matches are either going to be 2:30 a.m. or 6:30 a.m. Eastern Standard Time for Australia. So not the best timing, really, is it?
Now, a few players that were set to play in the Canadian Global T20 and now have pulled out. Three Americans in Stephen Taylor, Jesse Singh, and Timil Patel. And this is all due to the American central contracts that have been rolled out over the last week per Peter Della Penna at Crick Info, friend of the podcast. Just on the American central contracts, Ali Khan and Hayden Walsh Jr. have opted not to take central contracts in order to play both the Canadian T20 and the CPL as well. They'll still play for the USA on a match fee basis. Had they taken the central contracts, they would have been denied no objection certificates, which would have meant, yeah, that they would have been stuck in limbo. A few other players who have been given one-year central contracts, 12 others have been given three-month deals. So the five players with the 12-month contracts are Stephen Taylor, Xavier Marshall, Monank Patel, Aaron Jones, and Jesse Singh. Roy Silva is one player that hasn't been given a deal at 39. Just seems as if the USA are looking to the future. Nick, you discussed the idea that Jesse Singh getting a 12-month deal was an interesting selection, perhaps.
Yeah, well, he hasn't done a whole lot for them in recent times, and he's certainly not been in the top five players when he has even been on the field. So, yeah, it's a bit of a strange one, that. Yeah, potentially it was a case of Ali Khan and Hayden Walsh Jr., maybe they were higher priority and Jesse Singh just kind of filled up the last spot by default when the other two guys knocked them back or something like that, maybe. But you'd think there would be other players with maybe more claim to being in the top five players, but who knows what's going on there. As for Roy Silva, I think you're absolutely right. This team, you know, is 39. They're probably looking to build for the next few years in the Cricket World Cup League 2 tournament that's going on. And, you know, he'd be 41 by the time that finished. So I just think they've put him out to pasture. And he's done great service to the US cricket team over the years. But, you know, these days his batting doesn't come off that much. And his bowling's, well, I would call it military medium, but that sort of implies some kind of discipline.
Oh.
You know, maybe it's more like a private security contractor mediums, you know. He kind of does the same job, but it's a bit more expensive and a bit less reliable.
I'm just thinking that analogy may have been, that was stretched as far as it could go, which I appreciate.
Love a good analogy. Well, speaking of Roy Silva being put out to pasture, the Hong Kong Blitz has been put out to pasture, Tim. The T20 Blitz has been scrapped due to, a few reasons. Lack of sponsorship interest, difficulty in assessing government funds for major events, and the recent results of the men's national team have all been cited as reasons for its demise, Tim. On a personal note, how does it feel for it to be no longer? And what do you think, if there are any silver linings, what do you think they are?
Well, first and foremost, I'm really disappointed. Just for the cricketing community in Hong Kong, you know, this is the first event in a long time that had really galvanized a somewhat disparate community together in accessing investment that we'd never seen. You know, beforehand, it was perhaps sponsors for the Sixers in years past, but that was haphazard. And to get five great franchises, the event did, you know, with the cross ownership between PSL champions Islamabad United, you know, that their owners were actually based in Hong Kong, and to start a franchise. We had the owner of Woodworm Cricket run a franchise the first year, and also the amazing Kowloon Cantons, the nine ladies and one man who got together with it, the reason that we know who Sandeep Lamachani is, or at least we did soon enough. And then, of course, for the City Kai Tak franchise to start in Hong Kong, and the group of friends who got together to run that have now gone on to purchase the St. Kitts and Nevis Patriots in the CPL. And that's in a nutshell of the people that were involved and the type of spectacle we had with 25 international players each year. And to see it scrapped the way it has been, or at least to be told it's going to be scrapped, the franchise owners themselves haven't been told, which is absolutely ludicrous for an event that's worth up over $2 million a year, as in US dollars investment, and how much was plowed into the broadcast last year. I'm really at a loss, to be honest. And of course, I've left Hong Kong and it's been 4 months since I've been gone, but the players themselves, but in the national team or in the leagues who are looking forward to it, don't know what's going on. And to go after the Sixers, well, to continue with the Sixers after it was just as much of a financial failure last year, or financial as much invested into it as the Blitz last year. And I think the future's only in and around T20 franchise cricket when it comes to places like Hong Kong. I just don't get it.
Yeah, it's a strange one, isn't it, Tim? The Sixers, sort of, I mean, they were a bit before their time, really, for what they were doing, you know, 20, 25 years ago, but nowadays I think they're a bit of a relic. And I mean, there's a bit of nostalgia around them, so perhaps, I guess, Hong Kong thought they could maybe capitalise on that somehow. But yeah, I think you're right, absolutely, that T20 is definitely the future, 100 ball cricket notwithstanding.
Yeah, and even if it was T10 cricket, it's shorter to get into that shorter window, which the Blitz's advantage that we're able to fit it in between major tournaments, meaning we could get the likes of Sangakkara, Sammy, Bell, Smith, you know, all of these names that just roll off the tongue have played T20 cricket in Hong Kong and loved it. And now they're not going to be coming back because they're not going to be coming and playing for these Sixers teams. But as you mentioned, that the Sixers being a relic, and you know they were before their time. And I think if you go back, South China Morning Post have digitized a lot of their stuff from the late 90s and early 2000s. Shane Warne actually got involved, or his brother did, and Shane Warne did it at running this thing called the I-Sixers, which would have been an Asia-wide franchise event, more along the lines of a Hong Kong Sevens, i.e. rugby sevens, rather than a cricket tournament that had been seen elsewhere. But in the end, the Asian Cricket Council, I think, in the end vetoed it, said they weren't going to back it. I don't think Hong Kong themselves were going to back it either. But, you know, somebody had the forethought there for what the Sixers could be. And I think even when people bring it up now, it's like, don't get me wrong, a standalone thing, I don't think it's got any future. But in terms of weekend-long festival-type events that get people there with entertainment, with cricket, I think ultra-short format cricket still could have a place. But I think over time, we've seen T10 cricket come in, and where the 100 fits in, whether that's played anywhere else around the world, and the Sixers have just been left behind. You know, compared to the cricket we saw, well, that I saw live, you know, in 2018, we had 5 days of high-class T20 cricket played with some of the stars of the world, like, alongside up-and-coming and high-performing Hong Kong cricketers. We saw Nazaka get player of the match in the final. We also saw players like Haroon Ashad come through being led by Kumar Sangakkara and backed with the ball to bowl the last over and win matches for the Gladiators. And the Sixers, we had cricketers coming around from around the world smacking a ball around on synthetic turf over 2 days and then take a trophy and leave. You know, it doesn't, you know, with a team of Hong Kong players, six of them playing it, versus 6 per 11 over 5 franchises in the Blitz. You know, it doesn't take Einstein to work out where the biggest advantage there for Hong Kong cricket is. So, yeah.
Yeah, well, I guess sort of reiterating the point that Nick put and you added on to was that Hong Kong has kind of always had a special place in short format cricket, and it's been sort of that carnival-esque, or what you've ended up turning into a week-long Blitz tournament, which actually has a really nice place in world cricket in its own right, in its own little niche. And that's why I thought it worked and it was really effective. I thoroughly enjoyed the T20 Blitz when we had it on Fox Sports in Australia, because it was great to watch quality international talent, but it was good to give the Hong Kong national team players and other domestic players a chance to really show their stuff. And I thought it was an outstanding tournament. And one of my favorite stories in it all was when Ben Lachlan just came out from winning a Big Bash to basically being thrown straight into the T20 Blitz. Did he win that as well?
Yes. So yeah, he won the final with the Strikers on the Sunday night, and he was on a plane the next day, or was it the Tuesday, to be playing on the Wednesday for the Hong Kong JD Jaguars. And look, the wicket was a little bit tacky in those early days, and that was just absolutely perfect for him. It was like he was bowling off breaks at some stage. Yeah, but that was great. He had 2 winners' medals within 8 days.
Not many people can say that in their cricketing career. But yeah, once again, it is hugely disappointed to see no Hong Kong T20 Blitz.
As you say that, Bez, I think that it's going to be interesting as time goes on, because as I recall, there might be a stipulation in the contracts between the teams and the holding company that there is a 2019 Blitz. So it's going to be interesting to see how this all plays out, and hopefully it's not going to be playing out in the courts. But if there was an opportunity for the owners to get together and perhaps even buy the event back from China Cricket International, which is the wholly owned subsidiary of Cricket Hong Kong, to run it, you know, considering they're struggling so much to get sponsors for the Sixers, you think they're better to put all their eggs in one basket, and as they say, many hands make light work, to have all the franchises working together. I think you could still run a pretty lean, mean tournament with some of the contacts that those teams have. And let's not forget, We've seen Yuvraj Singh sign for the Global T20 in Canada. Indian players are available to be picked up, negotiated the right way, and that could just be the little edge that it needs to potentially get that TV rights deal that they almost got when we had Yusuf Pathan. See, to me, this would almost be a reason to push a little bit harder and to lean towards the T20 event, because the BCCI are never going to send an Indian team to the Sixers, but Hong Kong may have been able to get one or two key Indian players that would have got that interest. And that's why this decision just astounds me, really, considering the change that we've seen on the T20 landscape.
Well, from one carnival to another of cricket, and the European Cricket League starts next Monday in La Manga in Spain. Of course, the brainchild of Daniel Weston and his team of organizers, a fantastic tournament lined up in La Manga in Spain. Just going through the format, it is a T10 league with two groups of four. Of course, all the teams in this competition are domestic champions of their respective countries. So we have the two groups, VOC Rotterdam of the Netherlands, Svanholm Cricket Club of Denmark, Cluj of Romania, and France's Dreux Cricket Club. They all make up one group. In the other group, we have Catalunya of Spain, St. Petersburg in Russia, Gianjua Brescia of Italy, and SG Findorf of Germany. It's a three-day comp with pool play in the first 2 days. The final day of the ECL will have minor placing playoffs in the morning, with both semi-finals and the final played out in the afternoon. It's all set to come into reality, boys. There's been a lot of planning by Weston and his team. He says he's got over 30 people working on it now. We're very much looking forward to it. It's going to be streamed in over 100 countries as well.
And on TV as well. It's also Fox Sports, Freeview. I think he's got deals galore around the world. But I couldn't help but mention, you did say St. Petersburg. Which country is that in?
I said in Russia.
Yeah. What did we hear during the week that Russia has formally refused to acknowledge cricket as a sport?
Yeah, that's just one of the challenges that Russian cricket has. I did, read the same story. But Russia is a country that only recognized beer as an alcoholic drink and not as a soft drink only a couple of years ago. So to say that they've got their things mixed up a little bit at times, I think would be an understatement.
I wonder if that would be different if cricket was in the Olympics.
I dare say it would be, yes. I think that's what a lot of people alluded to when they did break the story about Russia, but that's a story for another day. I think it's also important to note the other key members of Weston's team committed to developing cricket on the continent. Roger Finer, the CEO, he's a director of broadcasting at FIFA. He also has Thomas Kluse and Frank Landers on his team. They were two men who orchestrated what is now one of the biggest sporting competitions in the world, in what is the UEFA Champions League. So three players in Weston's corner that are going to be absolutely crucial in the development of this competition.
Just on the TV deals, I think it's interesting that, with all the chat about, cricket going on free-to-air TV in England and that whole debate, I think it's interesting that Dan Weston's managed to get his little ECL tournament onto free-to-air TV in England when, the ECB can't manage to get any of their cricket onto the free-to-air.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to seeing production quality in this year one. As he said in that interview that we played last week, that he really sees next year as the first year, and this just as a bit of an entree. But knowing how much effort they've gone to, of course, we're going to see emerging cricket up in lights on the advertising hoardings, which I'm looking forward to see. But look, he doesn't do anything in halves, does he, Mr. Weston? We thought, I think I can cover cricket differently. So he went out and bought 16 GoPros.
I believe it was 18.
Well, 18. That ain't normal behavior, is it? So I like a little bit of eccentricity.
Yeah, no, I just think that not only does he have the drive, he puts it into action straight away, and he has an incredible CV in his own right, and he's a German national team player as a wicketkeeper as well. So he kind of ticks all the boxes in terms of how he wants to go about it all. And yeah, again, to have the three others in his corner and being able to move this into fruition, after all the talk, I'm extremely excited to see the finished product.
Yeah, and just as we were talking about how Russia, I guess, doesn't recognize cricket as a sport, it's funny that sort of comes out around this time, because Mexico's just recently started the process of trying to become a federation, which obviously getting official government recognition for the sport, which would unlock some government assistance to help develop the game there. And actually caught up with Craig White, the Secretary of Mexican Cricket, to ask him about what it means and what the process is that they're about to undertake.
Well, I'm joined once again by Craig White of the Mexican Cricket Association. Welcome back to Emerging Cricket, Craig.
Hello, mate. I hope you're doing well.
So we've seen that Mexico has recently started the process to become a federation, a sporting federation in Mexico. Could you talk us through what exactly that means for Mexican cricket?
So what we see is there are three main benefits of becoming a federation. The first one is that we would become an officially recognized sport in Mexico, which means that we will be eligible for some government funding, although we don't know the amount. The second one is that we would become part of the Olympic Committee, and this would enable us to support the ICC efforts to get cricket in the Pan American Games. And the third one is that we will become part of the Ministry of Sport, which means that the government would give us access to spaces to play cricket, and also they would help us to train teachers. We would also get proper support and proper access to schools so we can really develop cricket from a grassroots level. At the minute, we are all volunteers and we are doing the best we can to grow and develop cricket. But by becoming a federation, we will get the proper help and support that we need to grow cricket. We are so excited about becoming a federation, because this is going to give us the infrastructure to really grow cricket in Mexico.
Are there any sort of case studies or examples from other sports of how exactly federation status has helped them to grow?
We met quite recently the head of the Mexico Rugby Federation, because we are about 10 years behind them in terms of development. And he told us that before they were a federation, they were an association just like us. They had about 200 players in Mexico City. But when they became a federation 10 years later, they have now rugby in all 32 states in Mexico, and they have about 8,000 players across the country. So by becoming federation in 10 years, they went from 200 players in Mexico City to 8,000 players across Mexico.
And what exactly are the, I guess, requirements or legal steps involved in becoming a federation, and what's the expected time frame on this?
Well, we have a legal team in place to do this for us, and it's actually a lot easier than we thought. All you need is to become a federation. You need three legally recognized, legally established associations for the sport that you're involved in. And then once you have the three legally recognized sporting associations, from that you create a federation. So in the case of cricket, we have organized cricket in Mexico City, Jalisco, Querétaro, and Nuevo León. So we have cricket organized in four states, but these four places, they are not legally established. So what we are going to do is we are going to legally establish, with bylaws, legal representatives, the lot, Mexico City, Jalisco, and Nuevo León. And once we have these three associations that are legally established, with those in place, you then legally establish the federation, and the federation will have its own legal representatives, its own governing rules, and things like that. And our lawyer, he estimates that we can have this done by the end of 2019, and it will cost about $8,000 to get the whole thing done.
And just before we let you go, I believe there's some news coming out of the Mexican women's team. Could you update us on that?
I don't know if you saw us. We've had Eileen and Erica Fernandez. They're in Madrid at the moment. They're practicing with Madrid Cricket Club, and they were recently invited as the guests of Cricket Spain to attend the ICC Europe Women T20 qualifiers. They went as the guests of Cricket Spain to watch the qualifiers, and they had a fantastic time, and Cricket Spain were just amazing. Bit of sad news today as well. We've lost Anne-Julie Ladron from the women's team. She's just been offered a contract with a Mexico women's Premier League football club, and well, it's an opportunity too good to pass up. So she's took the contract, and she's going to be playing, women's Premier League football. And well, unfortunately, we've lost her to cricket.
And once again, thank you to Craig White, Secretary of the Mexican Cricket Association, for speaking with Emerging Cricket.
He's been, a regular contributor to some of our work. Let's wrap up today's show. A story out of Rwanda. Rwanda renewing their sponsorship of domestic cricket leagues with Uni Money for their Rwandan Premier League, which has just got underway, actually, on the Sunday that's just gone. 24 clubs in that Rwandan championship, which is great to see. Some other stuff. Just wanted to remind you guys that we will review the Ireland-England Test match on the show next week, as it does play out as we do release this podcast. And that's the same for the T20 World Cup Asian qualifiers, which have begun, but we did want to sort of review all of that next week when it was done and dusted. Boys, if you have nothing to add, I think that's all for today's show.
No, nothing more to add. I think we've done well. I hope that everyone got through with just the three of us and a little bit of Geordie thrown in there at the end, but we'll host it again.
What are you laughing at, Skinner?
Just getting a nice little pat on the head there from Tim, aren't you?
Well, he does well.
He can pat me on the head considering the bloke's about 6'5". It's just, I'm an armrest. To keep up with news from Cricket's New World, make sure to follow Emerging Cricket on your favourite social media platform. And please make sure to give us a 5-star rating wherever you are listening to your podcast and whichever of the 70-plus countries that you are listening to us. For now, from me, Daniel Beswick, enjoy the rest of your day wherever you are around the cricketing world. Thank you to Tim.
Thank you, Bez.
And thanks a lot for your time as well, Nicholas.
Pleasure as always.
Brilliant, boys. I will catch you next week. For now, from me, enjoy the rest of your day wherever you are around the cricketing world.